Hello, and welcome to The Rounds Table, our weekly podcast about major new research in medicine. We're thrilled to be hosted online at healthydebate.ca. My name is Amol Verma. I'm a resident in internal medicine at the University of Toronto. Today I'm joined by Fahad Razak, my good friend and longtime contributor to The Rounds Table. Fahad is a staff general internist at St. Michael's Hospital and the David E. Bell Fellow at the Harvard Population and Development Center. Hey, Fahad, how's it going?
Amol, great to be with you.
It's a pleasure to have you, as always. So today, Fahad and I are doing a bit of a cardiovascular-themed episode. Fahad is going to talk about blood pressure lowering based on cardiovascular risk, and then I'm going to be talking about the Arctic Interruption Trial, which was looking at dual antiplatelet therapy in patients with coronary stents, and it was a study that was recently published in The Lancet. So before we start, I'm going to make a quick plug and a plea. I'm going to ask all of our wonderful, generous, kind, giving listeners. So if you can't tell, I'm buttering you up and asking you to please go online at healthydebate.ca and fill out our very brief survey to give us some feedback on the podcast and how it's going. Our intern is using this to do an evaluation of the program, and it would be very helpful for us to know what you think and how we can make the project better for you. Okay. So let's move on. Fahad, tell me a little bit about blood pressure lowering based on cardiovascular risk.
Okay, so I'm going to talk about an article that was just published in The Lancet, and it looked at whether blood pressure lowering has different effect based on your baseline level of cardiovascular risk. There's also an accompanying editorial that's pretty informative about this article. So the major finding of this article is that, similar to how we currently decide on whether we should use lipid-lowering therapy such as statins, that you can use risk prediction equations for people with cardiovascular disease to decide on how much benefit they get from starting antihypertensive therapy.
Interesting. So sounds intuitive to me, but you know, now that you say it, it's kind of an interesting question why we don't do that already. So what's the background here?
So some of the broader background about the epidemiology of hypertension is that there's a lot of research to show that blood pressure has a continuous relationship with cardiovascular disease and other kinds of vascular disease. And there's no clear inflection point. So there's no clear point where you say everyone on this side should be treated, everyone on that side shouldn't be treated. Also, the benefits of antihypertensive medication has been shown in both hypertensive and non-hypertensive patients at baseline. And we have trial evidence to support that. And finally, we know that the benefits of lowering blood pressure seem to be greatest if patients also have other vascular risk factors, things like dyslipidemia or diabetes. And so this idea of capturing baseline risk, it's been applied well in other areas, most notably in the treatment of dyslipidemia, where we use risk equations to decide when to treat individuals. But it hasn't caught traction in the hypertension world. And so these researchers examined whether it makes sense to use a baseline risk equation to determine the degree of benefit when you start blood pressure lowering medication.
Okay, that makes a lot of sense. And so how did they conduct this study?
So what they did is they conducted a meta-analysis of 11 trials that have looked at blood pressure lowering, a little bit over 50,000 patients. And all of these trials compared blood pressure lowering versus placebo. So they weren't comparing two different kinds of blood pressure medication, but a range of medications were used, everything from ACE inhibitors to calcium channel blockers. The primary outcome that they looked at was total major cardiovascular events, and these include things like stroke, heart failure, heart attacks, or death from any cardiovascular cause. And in order to create a baseline risk equation, they used common demographic factors, things like age or sex, comorbidities, things like obesity, blood pressure, smoking, diabetes, or cardiovascular disease. But notably, one thing that they didn't have in their risk equation was whether the patient had dyslipidemia or whether they were on statins.
Okay, so what were their major findings?
So the major findings was they used their risk equation to predict the baseline level of risk of all of the participants, and they broke them down into four major groups. The lowest risk category had a little bit under than 11% risk of having a major cardiovascular event over the next 5 years, and the highest risk category had more than 20% risk of having a cardiovascular event in the next 5 years. And what they found is when they looked at the effect of blood pressure medication, there was about a 15% relative risk reduction across all of these risk categories. And what that translates to is a greater absolute risk reduction depending on what your baseline risk is. So, for example, in the highest risk category, those with a baseline risk of more than 20% over the next 5 years. The number needed to treat was 26 to prevent one major cardiovascular event. In the lowest risk category, the number needed to treat was 71.
Okay, so that sounds like a pretty big difference between the two groups. So what's your takeaway from this? What's your application, sort of, where do we turn this information into clinical practice?
Right. So my major takeaway is that this study demonstrates pretty rigorously that categorizing patients by their baseline cardiovascular risk level can help you determine the degree of benefit that they accrue from using blood pressure lowering medications. Now, the absolute benefit, not surprisingly, is greater the higher your baseline risk. And so the major implication from the use of these risk equations is that they may help us eventually better determine who will get the maximum benefit from the use of these medications.
So I think that that's a good point. I have to say, even in the lowest risk group, I guess the benefit of treatment is not insignificant in the sense that if you treat 70 people, you prevent one cardiovascular event, right?
Absolutely. So the reason that these guidelines, or the reason that these risk equations have not entered guidelines yet, is that the use of risk equations to determine the degree of benefit from using blood pressure medications has not been widely established prior to this study. So what will undoubtedly follow after this study is a cost-effectiveness analysis to determine whether a number needed to treat of 70, for example, does merit the use of these medications.
Yeah, I have to say, so let's be honest about this study and our relative enthusiasm for this. So I actually really thought that this was important and interesting, and I'm kind of excited about it. You're a little less enthused, right?
I'm actually pretty excited by this study, even though my voice may not convey that. And the reason why I'm excited is that the use of a risk equation to me fundamentally makes sense. It's a logical step in optimizing treatment. We know that patients differ in their risk level by more than just their blood pressure level. And so bringing in other factors to help determine the degree of benefit makes a lot of sense. I think this is a first important step, but certainly it's not ready at this point to apply to clinical practice.
Okay, so I was trying to sort of develop a little antagonism here, but clearly I failed. And we both sort of come down on the same side that, one, I guess hypertension is such a prevalent and important public health problem that improving our science and our approach to treating it makes a lot of sense. And I think the more we can get to a better risk assessment for individual patients would really help people make individual decisions, especially because effects of hypertension are often downstream, whereas the costs of actually taking medication, both financial and otherwise, are, you know, much more immediate, right? So people are unlikely to, if your risk is low, there may be a compelling reason, or people may choose not to be treated.
Yeah, I agree with that. I think this could help with some of the more nuanced decisions about using blood pressure medication. But what's notable from these trials is that actually there's a minimal representation of people with mild hypertension and otherwise low risk. So the very category where you would hope for some additional information to make decisions, this risk equation doesn't give you a lot of information about these patients. And the trial data doesn't have patients that represent that category. And so it's actually a little bit cloudy to me how this is going to impact clinical practice, even if it's developed further, because patients who have very high baseline levels of blood pressure are put on treatment anyway, and this risk equation would tell you to put them on treatment. But it's the patients that are at low risk and still have mildly elevated blood pressure that sometimes it can be difficult to determine what to do, and this equation doesn't guide us.
Okay, so maybe this is really, I think, a step in the right direction, but it sounds like there are a few steps before this makes it to tangible clinical practice into guidelines. Would you say that's probably accurate? What do you think are the next steps?
I think so. And I think that this also raises, to me, kind of a important example of how two very similar areas can develop in very different ways. And what I mean is that the use of risk equations in determining who should be put on a statin, for example, is really well established. And yet you have this parallel cardiac risk factor of hypertension, where for some reason there isn't a risk equation. We just make decisions based on what people's blood pressure levels are. And this risk equation at the very least shows that using a baseline risk approach makes sense. So it's interesting from a research point of view, and it has a lot of clinical implications about why we treat these two very similar cardiac risk factors so very differently when we make clinical decisions.
Yeah, I think that's like a fascinating intellectual history question of how did these two fields evolve so differently when they're so related? Something I'd love to actually look into more. I don't know if you have any insight off the top of your head or...
I don't, and it's a really interesting question. And the editorial that accompanied this article actually didn't explore why, but they hinted to the fact that there has been pushback in the hypertension community to use of a risk equation. And I guess the bigger question is why, and something that I don't know at this point.
Agree. Okay, why don't you wrap up, Fahad, and tell us what the major takeaway points from this study are.
So these results make a compelling argument that assessing baseline risk is useful when determining the degree of benefit that individuals will have from starting medications for their high blood pressure. However, the results are not ready to apply to clinical practice.
You sound like Travis. Okay.
wait till my good stuff.
All right. Thanks, Fahad. Let's move on. So the study I want to talk about is called Arctic Interruption, and it was a study about dual antiplatelet therapy. And this study showed that there was no benefit to continuing dual antiplatelet therapy beyond 12 months in patients who have drug-eluting stents.
So, Amal, clearly the use of antiplatelets in people with stents is a very important clinical question. A lot of our patients have stents. What was the background before they did this trial?
Yeah, that's right. So the placement of coronary stents really is associated with two major complications. The first is the development of a blood clot in the stent, in-stent thrombosis. And the second is the reaccumulation of atherosclerosis around and in and around the stent, or stent restenosis. And the use of antiplatelet therapy is our major way of dealing with those complications. The recommended duration of dual antiplatelet therapy for drug-eluting stents specifically is between 6 and 12 months. And the recommended duration for treatment is mixed, and what's really unknown is whether there is benefit to continuing the dual antiplatelet therapy beyond those 12 months. And that's the question that these authors were trying to address.
So how did they go about testing this question?
Yeah, so this is actually a bit of an opportunistic study. It's an extension randomized control trial. So there was an original trial called the Arctic study that looked at titrating doses of antiplatelet therapy. And the main point here is that in that trial, there were 2,400 patients who took antiplatelet drugs for 12 months. So this trial took that study population and re-randomized the eligible patients to either continue those antiplatelet therapies for an additional 6 to 18 months or to stop antiplatelet therapy.
Okay, so what were the major findings from this?
They enrolled about 1,200 patients, so that's about half of the original study group, and randomize them to either continuing the antiplatelet or stopping it. And what they found was no difference between the groups in terms of their primary outcome, which was a combined endpoint that included all-cause mortality and cardiovascular events. They found that in the follow-up period, about 1% died in both groups. 1% of patients had an acute MI in both groups. 1% of patients required urgent revascularization in both groups, 1% had stent thrombosis in both groups, and 1% had stroke.
Sounds like a pretty compelling study to say no difference.
That is as good as it gets. The one difference that they did find was increased bleeding in the group that continued the dual antiplatelet therapy. So there was about 1% rate of bleeding in the continuation group versus less than 0.5% in the group that did not continue the antiplatelet.
Okay, so what are your main takeaways based on this evidence?
So the main takeaway point really seems to be that there's no apparent benefit to continuing dual antiplatelet therapy beyond 12 months, and there may be a small amount of harm.
Okay, so that seems to be the clear takeaway from this study, but wasn't there another recent trial that showed pretty different results looking at almost an identical question?
I kind of hate you for knowing medical literature so well. Yes, you're correct. So there was recently a paper published in the New England Journal of Medicine looking at a very similar question, and it was the dual antiplatelet therapy trial, the DAPT study. So in that study, they looked at about 10,000 patients. Again, similarly, randomly assigned them to continuing antiplatelet therapy beyond the 12 months. And they looked at 18 months, an 18-month extension. In that study, they found that there was reduced heart attacks in the long-term antiplatelet group, but there was overall increased mortality and increased bleeding in the long-term antiplatelet group. Now, the one caveat from that study is that they think that the increased mortality may have been because of an unlucky imbalance in the pre-existing cancer risk between the two groups at the time of randomization. But the major point is that from that other paper, the evidence is still not compelling that dual antiplatelet therapy is particularly beneficial beyond the 12 months.
But I would say in defense of the other paper that that trial was developed to answer this question, correct?
Correct.
Whereas the trial that you just presented, the Arctic trial, was a re-randomization of a pre-existing trial that was designed for a separate question.
Absolutely.
And so there must have been some implication for their power to detect a difference, or were there any further losses at the time of re-randomization?
Yeah, that's right. So, you know, one of the major things, as I mentioned, is that they only re-randomized about 50% of their original study population, and there were some differences in the groups. So the major reason that they were unable to randomize patients was a physician decision that the patients were not eligible for re-randomization. And it's not